Section 2, South Carolina, Progress and Poverty. As you read, look for problems for farmers caused by reliance on one cash crop and by a scarcity of money. The new industry that offered poor whites an alternative to sharecropping and tenant farming. The lifestyle of a mill village. How the railroads boosted the economy of small towns and brought northern visitors to the state. The effect of natural disasters on the economy. Terms: deflation, gold standard, textiles. Most colonists of South Carolina in the late 17th century made their living by farming, with rice just becoming the cash crop. In the late 18th century, most South Carolinians still made their living by farming, with cotton becoming the cash crop. Those who lived in the defeated and exhausted state of South Carolina in the late 19th century were probably still scratching out a living on a farm. Cotton was their familiar friend as well as their cruel master. The difference in the late 19th century was that another option appeared. Those who gave up on farming could go to work in one of the new factories. Agriculture, the old reliable. For two centuries, tilling the soil had been the reliable basis of the economy. Most families did not get rich farming, but most earned a decent living and had adequate food, clothing, and shelter. A few got very rich from agriculture because their efforts were multiplied by their slaves. The disruption and destruction of the Civil War made the return to prosperity seem like a distant dream to most. Production of cotton recovered, but prosperity did not. The sharecrop and crop lien systems kept most Carolinians poor. Crop diversity did not occur. Rice production never recovered from the loss of slave labor. The general decline in cotton prices hurt farmers. When the price of cotton went down, the farmer's response was usually to grow more cotton in order to keep up their income. Seeking new crops seemed too risky. Thus, more land was planted in cotton. Overproduction resulted, and the price went down further. Cotton had brought 28 cents per pound in 1869. In 1880, the price was 9.8 cents. In the 1890s, the price fell to 5 cents per pound. The farmers were not just plagued by overproduction, low prices, and a crushing crop lien system. They were caught in the grips of a nationwide, even worldwide, agricultural depression that lasted from 1873 to 1896. The depression was characterized by deflation, falling prices. Many farmers and workers wanted the government to go off the gold standard. The gold standard means gold is used to set the value of all money in circulation, such as silver or paper money. Debtors wanted the government to coin more silver and print more greenbacks, which would make money easier to come by. That did not happen. Farmers fell further in debt, and many lost their land. In 1886 alone, farmers lost nearly 1 million acres of land to their creditors or to the state for not paying their taxes. In the 1880s and 1890s, many white farmers became sharecroppers, joining the ranks of most black farmers. Very few could save enough money to move out west and farm the free land offered by the federal government. Some farmers in the 1880s in the PD area began to plant tobacco, a crop that had served Virginia well for so long. Tobacco companies of Virginia and North Carolina began to mass produce in large quantities by machinery, cigarettes for the first time. Cigarettes became all the rage in this country and in Europe. Their extremely addictive nature guaranteed a continuing market. By 1900, PD farmers had learned the techniques of bright leaf tobacco production and wanted to grow more. In the 20th century, tobacco was to become more important than cotton in the South Carolina economy. Rise of industry. Before the Civil War, William Gregg tried to convince his fellow Southerners that it made sense to bring the cotton mills to the cotton fields. However, very few followed his lead. John C. Calhoun had taught Carolinians well about the evils of industry. The war proved the power of industry as the North's industrial might overwhelmed the agricultural South. Finally, the South became more open to the possibility of developing manufacturing. The first major new industry, phosphate mining for the manufacture of fertilizers, had a short but dramatic lifespan. The state granted rights to companies to mine phosphate under Lowcountry rivers. South Carolina became the world's greatest producer of phosphate in the 1880s. Almost all the mine workers were African American. After the 1890s, richer deposits in Florida displaced this state's leadership in phosphate. However, South Carolina remained among the top five fertilizer-producing states until 1940. A few small antebellum industrial enterprises continued and increased their productivity in the final decades of the century. The pottery makers of the Edgefield-Aiken area still turned out their splendid products, and the slave named Dave continued shaping his magnificent pots as the free man named Dave Drake. The lumber and turpentine businesses continued to take advantage of the vast forest lands in the state. The production of cottonseed oil was increasing in importance. The textile industry. The manufacture of textiles, thread, yarn, cloth, and clothes, became the most important and widespread industry across the state. Every little community wanted a cotton mill, though most mills were in the Piedmont where water power was abundant. Local promoters fostered enthusiastic campaigns in the 1880s, preaching the virtues of building mills that would employ many poor white sharecroppers. Many communities, especially in Greenville, Anderson, Spartanburg, and Richland counties, were able to organize local funding for starting new mills. The investors expected profits, but were also motivated by civic pride and a hope for community progress. Local funds were not adequate for rapid growth, so more northern investors became involved by the end of the century. From 1880 to 1900, the number of cotton mills in the state increased from 14 to 115. The size of the mills grew with more capital invested in machinery and employees. Life in the mill villages. Mills were usually built on streams on the edges of towns or villages, but a mill had its own community, its own mill village. Like William Gregg, these mill owners built houses for workers to rent and ran a company store. The mill owners influenced their workers' lives by supplying churches and ministers, schools and teachers. The company also provided recreational opportunities, creating ball fields and baseball and football teams that competed with other mill village teams. The mill hands, as the workers were called, were all white, with the exception of an occasional black janitor. A typical day in a mill village would look something like this. Residents were awakened by the mill whistle at 5 a.m. Those who were about 10 years old or older started work at 6 a.m., had a half hour off for lunch, then worked until 6:30 p.m., a 12-hour workday. On Saturday, they worked only 9 hours to complete a 69-hour work week. Factories closed on Sundays. The noise was deafening. The factory was cold in winter and blistering hot in summer, and the cotton lint that filled the air stuck in workers' hair. People in town would call them lint heads, a term of criticism. Lint that entered the lungs was even more damaging, making lung disease more probable. Working men were paid about $4.50 to $5.50 per week. Women and children made less. It took the whole family to make a living. Workers may not have been fond of the disciplined and regimented nature of their new life, but they liked the security of a steady cash income. They could be laid off at any time, though, and neither the owner nor the government had any responsibility to offer help. Railroads. Just as every town and village in South Carolina wanted a cotton mill, every community also wanted a railroad. Every village wanted to be the depot to which the farmers brought their crops to be shipped away. An article in the Horry Herald in the 1880s tells of the transformation the railroad caused in Conway. Quote, "Only a few years ago, we were completely isolated from the world, struggling along in darkness and eking out an existence of a precarious, insecure, and uncertain kind. Then came the revolution in the shape of the railroad, and with its advent, new life seemed to be infused into us." End quote. Greenville experienced a similar new life and economic growth when that little town was connected to railroads. At the end of Reconstruction, the state had just over 1,200 miles of track. By 1900, it had nearly 4,000 miles, and every county was linked in. Most rail companies began with only a few miles of track. By the turn of the century, many of the small lines had been bought out and consolidated into three large interstate railway companies. This was a trend in the whole country, where seven huge systems dominated most of our nation's 193,000 miles of track by 1900. The railroads helped shape the agricultural and industrial future of the state and nation. Resort towns. Several towns fancied themselves candidates to become health resort communities for wealthy Northerners if only they could get a railroad and a large hotel. Aiken had shown the way when the South Carolina Railroad from Charleston to Hamburg came through the area in 1833. The town gained a reputation among Charlestonians as a healthful escape from the coastal heat and outbreaks of malaria. After the Civil War, Aiken advertised in the North for winter tourists to come and enjoy the warm climate. A new major hotel accommodated the Yankees. By the 1890s, Aiken's economy floated on the wealthy families from the North who built lavish homes they called cottages in the town and established a center for golf, polo, horse racing, and fox hunting. An Aiken native said that, quote, "We lived on Yankees in the winter and blackberries in the summer," end quote. Camden joined Aiken in the 1880s as a health and tourist resort for wealthy Northerners who loved horses, racing, golf, and mild winters. Camden was served by three railroads and three grand hotels. Northern visitors bought and helped preserve many fine antebellum homes. Somerville had always been a getaway for Charlestonians. Late in the 19th century, the town became a health resort and tourist destination for a broader range of visitors. It had several large hotels and tuberculosis sanatoriums, places for recuperation. Natural disasters and the economy. Cities and states can never predict nor fully prepare for natural disasters, but those catastrophes have great effects on economic activity. In 1886, Charleston experienced the most powerful and destructive earthquake ever to hit the Southeast. 83 people died, and the city lost nearly one-fourth of the value of its buildings, a staggering economic blow. Somerville also lost many buildings, but the city's rebuilt, this time with an eye for sturdier buildings. Hurricanes and tropical storms have shaped and reshaped South Carolina's coast since time began, and the economy since human habitation. Twice in the late 19th century, serious hurricanes crashed into the state. On August 25, 1885, 21 people were killed in Charleston, and 90% of the houses were damaged, many beyond repair. In the Great Storm of 1893, a more widespread hurricane killed about 2,000 people. Do you remember? Define in sentence form deflation, gold standard, textiles. 2. Why were most South Carolina cotton mills located in the Piedmont? 3. What two features were necessary for a South Carolina town to become a health resort community for Northerners? Which towns succeeded in this pursuit?